problem. And he said, I'm in a terrible time with Dad. He can't hear anymore, and he won't wear a hearing aid. So why not? He said, well, it's just a matter of he doesn't want to. So I pressed him on it real hard the other day, and Dad finally said to me, he said, listen, he says, I get up in the morning. His dad has an artificial limb. So I get up in the morning, I put on my leg, I put on my hair, I put in my teeth, I put on my glasses, and I'm not going to plug myself in. I would like to take just a couple of minutes to wind up what we were talking about yesterday, sort of a capsule review, and then maybe if there are any questions, we can pick it up from there. Part of the whole poverty program, of course, now is the attack which is being made on it by the federal government, the Office of Economic Opportunity, which will be very fascinating to watch. Massive attack of this sort to see whether or not it does any good. I heard a summary of it by some of their spokesmen recently, and one of them in particular said that we are not so naive as to think that anything that we can do by way of head starts and so forth will rapidly overcome this problem, but it is designed to attack sources, causes, do some prevention work. His guess was that perhaps if the government worked very hard, exerted lots of effort and spent lots of money and employed lots of people, that perhaps in 10 years they could overcome the basic problems and claim a total victory and discontinue the problem. And then he says, of course, there'll be 6 million people unemployed, which is a rather interesting observation. I think they've hired just about that many in the state of Washington already. The point of what I was trying to get at with the Pope's statement yesterday, peace on earth, was that I think it's quite an error to start thinking about anyone as having a right to food or shelter or clothing or education or life or anything else. I don't think that we advance our cause when we think of this in terms of a right. Because a right means something that you are entitled to, that you've paid for, or that you've earned, and that you're entitled to demand, and if you don't get it, you can resort to some sort of forceful means of enforcement, you see, to get it. And I don't think that's true. I certainly don't think it's true of a man's relation to God, and I don't think it's true of one man's claim to another man, either, in any sort of a legal system until such prerogatives are established either by statute or else by common agreement, the common law sort of development. And I think it's rather injurious to the Christian's position to think of welfare, public assistance, charity, whatever name you want to put to it, as being a matter of right for two reasons. One reason is that as soon as you say that every man has a right to an equal share, or at least to certain minimums, you destroy the flexibility which is so necessary if we want to go at this thing with our heads as well as our hearts. Because if there are only a limited number of dollars available to do the job, that money has to be spent at the place where it'll do the most good. And that means that it may be necessary to look at some cases and say that as much as this hurts, this case is simply beyond economic assistance. We simply can't afford to help that case. And we'll have to use our money somewhere else. Now, that kind of flexibility is available to you if you don't regard the right theory as being controlling here, but rather one of adjustment on terms of utility and in terms of where the money that is available to us, or the help that is available to us, will do the greatest amount of good. Second point is, personally, is even a stronger one in my mind, and that is to say that every man has a right, meaning a natural law right, to each of these things, really deprives me of my function as a Christian. I can use the state to take care of the adjustments through taxation and through the minimum food, shelter, clothing, education thing, but beyond that, it is my privilege as a Christian to give to another person as a free gift something to which he is not legally entitled. And if I must regard him and his needs as being simply a matter of giving him what is legally his, what is due to him, what I can be compelled to give him, and that which I give him simply because it is my duty to give him, not my response freely as a matter of choice, then this natural law approach would deprive me of what I see as the most valuable function that Christ gives me in my freedom to do or not to do, and to react to God's constraining love, the response, freely, rather than being dragged in reluctantly by the heels. That's what I was trying to talk about yesterday. Only a fool would tackle a problem like poverty or unfair competition inside of a 45-minute stretch. And after having this blistering commentary from Beanie this morning about concluding on time, where are you, Beanie? I'll demonstrate my foolishness again by tackling this next one and seeing what I can do with it. Same rules this morning as yesterday. That is, when something doesn't come out clearly or when you want to correct me in my error, wiggle your hand and we'll stop and work with it. I think that the opening chapter of the first book of the Bible is the place to start with this one. And that is that God did give man the means of earning, developing — earning is perhaps a bad word, but developing — exercising dominion over the plants and vegetables, those things which were created for man's good. The earth is full of riches, and man has been put in a position where he can exercise his dominion. Now, indeed, it will be in the sweat of his brow, because we live in the kind of a world that we do live after the fall. Still, we are talking now about the fact that God has given us the prerogative and the opportunity, and I think as we face each other, the responsibilities legally in our own system of law, of doing these acts which will be rewarding to us mutually. And we've come a long way. Our lives today are much more comfortable, and that, I think, is a good thing, not a bad thing. I think this is, as I see it at least, God's purpose for us, to be well-fed and well-clothed and well-housed. The question is, how do we get there? How do you do this? Paul Hayne has already illustrated very nicely how the economic operation develops more and more goods, consumable goods, and goods generally for the benefit of man through the operation of a competitive system. And I must start this morning by saying that in the United States, at least, there is a presupposition that competition is a good thing. This is sort of the place from which we start in our whole economic picture, legally at least. We don't really go back to question whether or not competition is good. That is a place which we start. The problem for the lawyer is the problem of how do you keep the society competitive, and at what points do you draw lines and say this has now become destructively competitive? Because we do recognize differences between what is helpful competition and what is destructive competition. And here one might stop and say, how much like everything else we do in life, where we are forced to draw very difficult lines, because who really knows where a given practice is beneficial and where it becomes injurious? Because almost anything that one does, when pressed to an extreme, can become injurious rather than helpful. And it's perfectly clear that not to eat at all is hard on one's health. It's like the man who had the cow that he almost broke of the habit of eating, would have succeeded except the animal died. And on the other hand, it's obvious that for a person to eat far too much, to rich food and so forth, is injurious. Now the point is to get down and strike the happy medium in the middle and eat the right amounts of the right amount of food. That's the way it ought to be, you say. Now, how do you decide what to eat and how much of it? This is a matter of judgment. It isn't clear. This is not a thing where there are unvarying, undeviating rules set down. Rather, you test around and you see, you experiment a little bit. Maybe meat goes better with you and potatoes not so well, and this type of thing, and you try to find out by measuring it, testing it against standards of utility. This is true also of our economic system. Basically, the rule is that competition is good, just like it's good to eat. How much of what kinds of competition on what days are things which we test out and measure in terms of utility? Now, turn this inside out and look at it from sort of a philosophical point of view for a moment. And what I'm saying to you right now is that this is not, in terms of what kind of practices, the details, this is not a theological problem that we're talking about at the moment. This is a law problem. This is not something where God says that competition in this degree, in this amount, is God's will. There is nothing, in my opinion, there is nothing ordained by God about a particular form of government or a particular, a special, a unique form of economic behavior. A planned economy might be just as God-pleasing as a freely competitive economy. What God has said to us as the goal, as the principle, is use that form of social structure and economic behavior which is most beneficial to man, beneficial now in the terms of man's needs for food, clothing, shelter, education, the rest of the things which are necessary for man's proper living together. How you do it, however, is to be determined by man's head again, rather than by his heart. It is not a matter of God's dictating to us, but rather a matter of God saying to us, here is the equipment, there is the goal, you've got the intelligence and you've got the raw material, and now go out and do it. Notice once more in the first chapters of our scriptures that God announces to us, as we read it at the outset, that you aren't going to be totally successful in eliminating all the pain. The weeds and the tares are still going to grow. You're still going to have your problems. It will still be in the sweat of your brow. But you can nonetheless cultivate and improve and gradually upgrade the whole process. This, I think, then, if you will grant me what I have said so far about the relation which exists between the objective which God gives us and the means which we are to develop with the gifts that he has given us, is where the lawyer picks up his job of trying to implement this thing through legal means. The history of economic activity in the United States from a lawyer's point of view is a very interesting one. Back in the early days, we of course had a burgeoning type of using raw materials and struggling on a pretty open competitive pattern, I think. Our point of interest can pick up sometime around Teddy Roosevelt for a few presidential campaigns already at that point. Before Teddy came along, there had been planks in presidential platforms calling for laws to govern the excesses of economic power blocks that had been put together. Now, let's get that one straightened out in our thinking right now so that we've got it to work with. We say that we are a democratic society. For example, if there's going to be a governor or a legislative body which is going to control my life and my welfare, I get to vote for them. Names are put on a ballot and I go down and pull the lever. And I get to decide who's going to make these determinations that affect my life. But the president of Boeing Aircraft or Boeing Corporation is not on a public ballot. We do not nominate people to run for the board of directors of Boeing Corporation. But anyone who's ever been in Seattle and has even casually observed our situation will realize that as Boeing goes, so goes Seattle. And as Boeing goes, so goes the state of Washington. This is a dominating force in our society. If they prosper, we prosper. If they do not, we do not. In fact, what the president and the board of directors of Boeing Corporation decides in their board meetings probably has, maybe I overstate my position, but it probably has a more directly traceable effect upon my life than what the legislature does. After all, the legislature only gets at me indirectly with speed laws and things like that. Boeing decides what my wages are going to be, where I'm going to live, whether or not I'm going to have to move. Now, if a corporation which has amassed this amount of economic power is able to do that to you, and if we are in a democracy, should we then say, well, let's rise up, throw the rascals out, and nominate five men for the position of president of Boeing Corporation, put them on a public ballot, and elect them? Why do we not say that all utilities, all corporations, all business should be responsive to the public will expressed through the ballot box just as much as the president, the Congress, the governor, and the legislative bodies? Is it because we think we know less about how a corporation ought to be run than we know about how a government ought to be run? Or is the truth of the matter that we think that it's easier to run the government of the United States than it is to run Boeing aircraft? It's a less complex problem. That Lyndon B. has fewer really hard decisions to make than Mr. Allen, or that it doesn't matter as much, or what is our rationalization for this? Or is it that we think that corporations are most responsive to the public need when we let them run for themselves and struggle with each other for competitive advantage? And let us vote for that corporation, not in the ballot box, but in our dollars that we spend. Because really, when producers of goods and sellers of goods try to sell them to you, they are asking you to vote for their business, for their corporation. Every time you spend a dollar, you are making a determination that this dollar is going to be spent for a washing machine rather than a new haircut, or rather than for a suit or a bicycle or a movie or something else. Every time you spend a dollar, you vote that you want more washing machines or more automobiles or more something. And this method of popular voting gets back awfully quickly to the people who are taking the vote. And as you ask for more washing machines, take them off the market, and people see that they can sell washing machines, then immediately they start making more washing machines. Pretty soon they flood the market with washing machines, and you don't buy any more washing machines, and the price of washing machines go down. They don't make any more washing machines. This great principle, which I have just discovered, is called the law of supply and demand. And it's a very sensitive mechanism. What is the alternative to this? The alternative to this is the sort of planned economy all the way through. And Russia recently has given us some beautiful illustrations of this sort of thing. Let me use one just as a for instance here. They, of course, as you know, scientifically plan what they need and what they're going to consume and who's going to consume it and who's going to make it so that everything comes out even. Take the matter of nails, which was written up extensively recently in one of our publications. They sat down and figured out what kind of nails they had to have in order to run USSR for a year, and then they assigned the nail production, iron nails only, in this particular instance, to the various factories. And they assigned the production, the number of units of nails that had to be made, by weight. You've got to produce so many tons in this factory, and you've got to produce so many tons in that factory. Russia absolutely flowed with railway spikes. This, and bigger nails even, see? They had more big nails in order to get out the number of tons of nails that they needed than has ever been in Russia before. Well, obviously, this was no good. So the next year, instead of assigning it by weight, all the quotas were handed out in terms of number of nails that they had produce in their factory. Guess what Russia had that year? Tax! Carpet tax! Well, more tax in Russia than they ever had before. Now, this sounds stupid, but it literally and truly happened. And this is the point. Because what is the alternative if you want to plan it? You have to plan not only the number of nails and the size of the nails, But you have to know which factory is going to make which kind, and this becomes so complex that one of the Russian planners recently said that at present rates of projection, within another decade and a half, everybody in Russia will be planning. This is the immense complexity of trying to project what you need into the future and then set up your productive capacity. The alternative to it is to let you vote. Now, Paul said the other day, and I agree with him 1,000% on this one, that this matter of the consumer demanding the product and letting the production respond to it is not sort of an unplanned, chaotic thing. It really isn't. It's a very sensitive mechanism that's working here. And that is, I repeat, every time you reach down in your pockets and take out your dollar and plunk it on the table for a new hat, you're voting. And the voting mechanism there is an extremely sensitive one, because people react quickly to the color of cool green. We collect portraits of presidents more avidly than we do anything else, and people respond very quickly to this sort of market demand. It isn't unsystematic. It's highly systematized. The danger on the other side of it is that somebody can get in there and start stuffing the ballot boxes, that he can thwart, that he can derail the system. I believe that I mentioned the other morning that I wrote the antitrust law that the state of Washington has and our unfair competitive practices law that we have in this state. Before doing that, I took a summer off from my normal teaching duties and stole a position with Standard of California, because I wanted to see a large corporation from the inside to try and be sensitive to their problems before wielding an antitrust act. So I know what the problems of the relatively small independent consumer of goods are. I have been one. I've been a consumer of goods for almost as long as I can remember. I had never really had any experience looking from the inside out of a large corporation. One of the questions that I got to ask during this period that I spent with a large corporation, at that time about a $3 billion organization, was, do you people feel that you are exercising governmental power? Because that's the problem you see. Once you start derailing the competitive process, if you start exercising governmental power, if you start making governmental decisions, then you ought to be handled the way government is handled and be directly responsible to the people if we really are a democratic society. And Mr. O'Brien, who is a tremendous, fine lawyer, he's a great guy. I respect him immensely. He's one of the chief counsel for Standard of California, said, no, of course not. We are not. We are simply a private corporation, and although we are big and we have many, many different aspects of our business in different parts of the world, we do not exercise governmental power as such. We are simply looking after our corporation and in competition with others. 5 minutes later, we were discussing another problem. That was the Far East operation, which Standard was at that time employed. It was the time of the Suez Canal shutdown. And we were chatting about this, and I said to him, Chuck, did you know that Nasser might shut down the canal before it happened? And he said, oh, sure. Nasser came into the office on such and such a day, and he gave me the date. And we discussed this, what it would mean to the revenues of Egypt, what it would mean to Standard. And we talked about it for a while, and something back here kept ringing, and finally it came through to me. And I said, you know that that was several weeks before the United States government was approached on the question of whether or not the canal ought to be shut down? And he said, well, as I think about it, I guess that is true, that Nasser talked to Standard before they talked to the U.S. about the implications of closing down the Suez Canal. Now shall we say that this corporation is governmental? Well, Teddy Roosevelt said, we've got to bust the trusts. And this is the way we got into this picture. That any corporation which becomes so large, so dominant, so determining in its policies that it becomes an overriding governmental force must be reduced, because its very existence hangs like a smog over the entire economy, and it smothers the very competition that you're trying to preserve. It destroys, simply by its own weight, it destroys a competitive opportunity. A case that came along years after Teddy Roosevelt, but I'd like to talk about it for just a few moments here, will illustrate this. It's a case of the Aluminum Company of America, Alcoa, in battle with the United States government through its antitrust department, Attorney General's department. Alcoa had the original patents in the United States on the production of aluminum. And they lived corporately an almost sinless life. So Alcoa, the Aluminum Corporation, hardly sinned at all in terms of corporate behavior. They didn't viciously and underhandedly destroy anyone. They didn't enter into contracts which were designed to fix prices or other anti-competitive behavior. They prospered. They made aluminum and they sold it. They did a good job of it. They thought about the fact that you might like to have aluminum cookware, and so they developed aluminum cookware. They thought about the fact that aluminum might be useful for telephone wires and transmission of power, so they developed that. And they thought about sheet aluminum, so they developed that, and so forth and so forth and so forth. A patent finally expired for them. The patent finally expired. Patents are not renewable on basic processes and on commodities. The theory of a patent is that you give the inventor his 17 years to enjoy the results of his invention. The reason that you do that is to spur him on to invent more. So you promise him really a monopolist's rewards for 17 years. You protect him from competition. That's very anti-competitive. There is probably nothing that is more anti-competitive than a good governmentally regulated and protected monopoly. But the inventor is given that reward simply to spur him on to more inventions. Well, at the end of the 17-year patent period, Alcoa was the only aluminum producer in the United States. Obviously, it had the patent. Now, it's true that there was some aluminum trickling down from some upstart organization, probably flying the flag like we saw at breakfast this morning, called Aluminium. Alcoa had even managed to enter into a few trade contracts with them that fairly well kept this competition from being a serious threat to them. If there was any sin on Alcoa's part at all, it was in its relations with foreign producers of aluminum. But this wasn't a very serious sin in any event. It's sort of like being a little bit pregnant. That really was not very serious yet. At the end of the patent period then, suddenly the aluminum industry is supposed to be opened up for competition by all people. But who could really break into this market? So the argument goes. Alcoa had the factories, it had the people, it had the bauxite, the raw materials, it had the electric energy, it had the markets, it had the know-how. Anybody who wanted to hit this one had to take on a tremendous giant. Think about automobiles for just a moment, if you will. Who can really take on the big three in the United States and produce automobiles? Kaiser couldn't, and Kaiser wasn't exactly a little operation, you know. This guy has funds to work with and a fair amount of skill in industry. He couldn't make it. He yelled foul all over the place, sort of like Tucker's torpedo. They scream foul too, and the foul theory goes that, look, the other large producers of automobiles have tied up the railways and the highways, and I can't get steel to my factory in any way except by flying it in by air. And how can you compete in the automobile manufacturer if you have to bring in all your raw materials by air, if the railroads won't even cooperate with you? Probably didn't exist, as a matter of fact. The problem simply was that you had, in the Alcoa case, an extremely efficient organization grinding out aluminum at tremendous rates, doing a beautiful job. And as the judge, Judge Learned Hand, who is a tremendous guy, who wrote the opinion in this case, recognized, it wasn't that Alcoa had done anything bad, it was that they had done such a good job, that nobody was able at the moment to do a better job and get in there and take them on, and there couldn't be any competition. And then he comes to those famous lines in his opinion in which he says, is the reward for this kind of virtue and for this kind of great contribution to the American industry to be decapitation? Shall we slice up such a corporation and make little corporations out of it? Is that justice, to take a corporation which has behaved so well and to break it up into little pieces in order to have competition? Having let the full horror of that sink in, another 4 or 5 pages, he rushes back and says, yes, it is. Because a corporation which becomes so large, so smog-like, that it destroys the little fellow who's trying to get in the bottom is bad. Just per se, as we lawyers like to say, because nobody knows what it means. It just of itself, it is bad. It is in itself inevitably destructive of competition. And anything which is per se, can you remember those very difficult words? It's like per again. P-E-R, per se. Yes, per se, of itself, it's bad. It can't help it. It's just inevitably destructive of competition. Now, there are some other things which are inevitably destructive of competition. Agreements between competitors, which have no purpose at all except to eliminate competition between them, are inevitably destructive of competition. And they are per se unlawful. Hold on to that idea real tight for a moment, will you? We'll come back to it in just a moment. I want now to go to the opposite end of the thing and talk about letting the little guy get into a big business, making it possible for him to come in, to be a vital part of the competitive structure. I'm thinking of a famous case to me, never made the newspapers, I don't suppose, but it's one that I like. We regulate things in the United States in order that they'll go more efficiently. Nobody would deny that we need stoplights at corners. Nobody would deny that we need all sorts of regulatory schemes to keep things flowing along harmoniously. Walk on the right, don't run around on the left, you know, all of this sort of thing. We also regulate things which are dangerous in our economy, the way that you handle dynamite, the way that you handle any potentially dangerous commodity, including liquor. So we set up regulations about how whiskey ought to be produced and who can buy it and when it's going to be sold and the things that are being written on the labels. The government comes out full steam, you know, to protect the American public, like we've just done with cigarettes. We're going to write on the package now that these may be injurious to your health. That's a real firm, good statement there. Well, one of the things that the commission that handles whiskey says is that it must be sold in bottles which have a narrow neck at top. Now, there may have been a reason for that once upon a time, but I don't know exactly what it would be. There are some reasons for uniform packaging, obviously. A person ought to be able to compare what he's buying to see whether or not this is a better deal than that. Because if you get one bottle that's built like a champagne bottle, you know, the kind that has the bottom that goes right up to the cork on the inside, and if you happen to get any fluid inside, that's a pure accident. If you get two bottles that look the same shape on the outside, but one's all full of air in the middle, you're not getting as much and you can't do a comparison shopping, and thus competition is really hindered, because to be effectively competitive, you must be able to compare one deal against the other. Well, maybe this was the reasons it went into the shape and the size and the long neck top on a liquor bottle. Now, I want to talk about competition. There was a fellow down south who realized that most good Southerners are brought up drinking their white mule and other potables out of wide mouth jars, the kind that mother has in the kitchen. Because when you distill your own, you don't have a ready supply of long neck, narrow neck bottles. You put it in what's handy, and what's handy is of wide-mouthed jars. Now, with a whole population brought up to like their booze out of quart wide-mouthed jars, this fellow realized that if he wanted to really get in there and take on Seagram's and Shenley's, and that's the same company, incidentally, a subsidiary, there are very few producers of whiskey. What you see in not a whole bunch of companies is just a couple big ones on motorcycles with different names. This is an oligopoly. Oligopoly means competition by very few centralized firms. There are very few. This little guy, this upstart, this pipsqueak down south, wants to take on corporate giants. He's a guy who's going to make aluminum on the back burner of his wife's stove and take on Alcoa. Now this takes real competitive guts to go after a giant this way. So he sits down and he thinks, how can I break into this market? I don't have the $1 million worth of advertising to do. Whiskey is whiskey, alcohol is alcohol, except for a little flavoring we throw in. It's sort of like the additives in gasoline. Can't do it really on the merit of the product. It's a pretty well standardized thing. There must be some way that I can break into this market. Genius. All of a sudden, big flash. Put it in quart jars with wide mouth tops. So this guy starts, he paid his taxes, you understand. This is not a moonshiner. He's a legit operation. Only he put out the product in wide mouth jars. He took on the corporate giants. His business was simply skyrocketing. And the corporate giant then turned to the law and says, there is a law about putting out whiskey in long neck bottles. Make this guy line up and behave. And he says, what you're doing is trying to destroy competition. You don't like it that I'm taking away your customers by this new marketing scheme. Here the law said, well, we have regulations, and the regulations are that you've got to market your whiskey in bottles with long-necked, slender tops, like everybody else does. And this destroyed the newcomer, the guy who wanted to break into the market. There you have the heavy-handed, bumbling, inarticulate attempt to regulate by governmental action, which really destroys the very machine that we're trying to protect. And you've got a terribly difficult line to draw. Are you really going to say that things have to be packaged alike so that when you go into the grocery store, you can whip down two packages, competitors' products, and see at a glance that they really are comparable? Same kind of pack, same kind of content, same quality goods, same amount of sugar or whatever it may be, so that you can read the labels quickly and really see that this one is not as good a buy as this one? Or do you want to let a person be able to develop ingenuity and market in attractive packages in order to get a customer reception on something other than the value of the product itself? Not easy. These are the two extremes of the problem we're talking about this morning. On the one hand is the broad philosophical Sherman Act thing of saying don't let anybody impede with competition, the Alcoa case. On the other hand is the attempt to tell you what is a fair method of competition. One more illustration of that. The tell them how to compete business goes to such things as the Federal Trade Commission, which is the agency which polices some of these laws, says that you may not advertise deceptively. I'm about to get to the shave case now, but a quicker illustration of that first. And that is the Federal Trade Commission at one point saw an advertisement in the paper which said that a man was holding a sale for furs, and he had women's furs, and the seller said that he had thousands of furs to sell on this clearance sale. FTC rushed in and counted them. He only had 1,980 some. And so they enjoined his sale and his advertisement because obviously he didn't have thousands of furs to sell. He only had 1,980 some. If you want to advertise, you have thousands, you've got to have at least two of thousands in order to have plural. Now this is the kind of nitpicking, picayune stuff that gives you a real pain in the tummy when you think about it, trying to operate this way. This is like counting tacks and railway spikes in Russia. Yet once more, you are caught in what I really basically want you people to see out of this series of talks, if nothing else, and that is the painful and imprecise kind of decisions that we have to make in our life, where you're apt to make errors. And that's inevitable, see, because you're caught in this gray middle where you can't know what's going to work until you try it. All that you know is that you got to go ahead and try it. Frequently in error, never in doubt, confidence to sin. Sin boldly with confidence that you will be forgiven. It is part and parcel of our life. Back to Teddy Roosevelt. Voting public of the United States demanded that something be done about busting the trusts. And so we got the Sherman Act. Sherman Act in 1890. That's the parent act, the basic underlying philosophy of all of our antitrust laws. It starts out in Section 1 by saying that every, E-V-E-R-Y, every contract, combination, and conspiracy in restraint of trade is unlawful. Well, there isn't any contract which doesn't restrain trade. If I want to buy a winter's supply of coal and I make a contract to buy it from you, we have just eliminated your competitors. Every contract is in restraint of trade. I mean, it can't be otherwise, because as soon as you make one deal, you eliminate the competition. So, I thought about that when we drafted the act. Must mean every contract which improperly restrains trade. Every contract which restrains trade in a way that we don't want it to is unlawful. Now, those, of course, which are good for trade, those are lawful. And the businessman says, say that again, will you, Mac? I don't dig. Where are the lines? How do you tell one from the other one? Well, you go ask your lawyer. So along comes the first really big case in terms of Beanie's new liturgy this morning. This would be the daddy-o, the antitrust trade, the Standard Oil case, 1911. And the question was whether or not the particular activity was in restraint of trade or whether it was reasonable. Now, reasonable at the common law before the Sherman Act had meant, would this thing, this restraint, this contract, this restriction which the parties had agreed upon, was that geared reasonably to protect an interest which the person had, which was a legitimate and a legal interest? I give you an illustration. Take the case of the man who has a dairy company and delivers milk around town, since we've been talking about that, and he employs a driver to deliver the milk. And he says to the driver, now, if you want me to employ you, you must promise me that you're not going to just learn the names of my customers, my trade route out there, my milk route, delivery route, and work for me a couple weeks and then open up your own shop. Or when you buy a butcher shop from somebody else, a meat cutting shop, and the seller says this much money, and you say to the seller, are you going to move across the street and open another one, a newer one, and take all your customers with you and leave me nothing, say? If you want me to buy your business, you promise me that you won't go into competition with me. Well, of course, that kind of a restraint is a flat-out destruction of competition. Promise me in contractual form that you won't compete with me. Yet, if this is reasonably geared to protect the legal interest that you have, it's lawful. So if the butcher who sells his shop promises not to compete on that part of town in meats, 4 or 5 years, that's long enough to let you get the customer's goodwill yourself, that's reasonable. It's measured in terms of what is reasonably necessary to protect that interest. Now, if you buy the butcher shop from the guy and make him promise not to sell meat or shoes or clothes or boats or anything else in the United States for the rest of his life, that's a much, much, much broader restriction than is necessary to protect the little meat market that you bought. And it becomes unreasonable when it's measured against the interest which you're trying to protect. Likewise with the deliverer of milk. If you make him promise not to engage in any business anywhere for the rest of his life, that's much broader than you need to protect the names of the customers on your milk route. So when the Sherman Act case first went to the court said, well, this is a very easy case, really. The Sherman Act means that every contract or combination or conspiracy, which is unreasonably, all of that nice history back there in restraint of trade, is unlawful. If they're reasonable, they are lawful. That argument lost. And the argument that the Supreme Court of the United States bought was that if this is unreasonable in terms of not being good for competition, not measured against some specific concrete thing, but simply not good in terms of not good for competition, then it's not reasonable. It's per se unlawful. Remember those lovely words? While on the other hand, if it's good for competition, if it makes the society, the economy more competitive, then it is reasonable. And we will apply the rule of reason simply to see whether or not it's more than you need to get this sort of competition. The rule of reason rather than per se unlawful. And the court was very happy with this decision. And the businessmen screamed. They said, well, how do you know? And the court says, well, we know. We know, we can tell. And the businessman says, look, your honors, we can't go to Washington, D.C. every time we want to make a business decision. And what's more, this statute is a criminal statute. People can go to prison for violating the Sherman Act, and they can be fined $50,000 for violating the Sherman Act. Give us more precision in our guidance rather than simply what the court, in its unrestrained wisdom, thinks is good or bad. So agitation starts for much more precision in what is lawful and unlawful in antitrust. This is 1911, the Standard Oil case. 1914, we had two striking pieces of legislation. One, the Clayton Act, and the other one, the Federal Trade Commission Act. And these were highly touted as being the answer to the working man's prayer. He now was going to be told by chapter and verse what was lawful and what was unlawful in terms of restraining competition. It didn't come out that way. It turned out to be little Sherman Acts. Somehow or other, all of the precision which was supposed to be built into the thing never got through the statutory language, because it is almost literally impossible to write a text which is so precise and so detailed in its coverage that it does not do one of two equally evil things. Either it becomes so vague in actual application that it's meaningless, or becomes so precise that it's totally stultifying. The best illustration of total stultification that you can get, I better rephrase this, I was going to say it was Carol's Bible lesson this morning. That doesn't come out so well. It's the subject matter about which he was talking this morning. If you regard the laws, any laws, God's laws, man's laws, Sherman Act, Clayton Act, if you regard these as precise prescriptions, do it just this way. Sell all your whiskey in narrow neck bottles and nothing else. It becomes totally destructive and stultifying. Carol this morning was talking about new wine and new skins and new patches on old cloth and taking the grain as you go through the fields. If you read the commands as being prescriptive, telling you precisely what you have to do, you destroy competition totally and entirely. On the other hand, if you leave it up to somebody's judgment, to what he thinks is reasonable, you don't have the kind of guidance from day to day that you need to live by. And we are here once more in this constant, ongoing tension that exists in law as well as in theology between your needs to be guided and told what to do and to be free and left alone. And these are constant tug-of-war, constant tug-of-war, back and forth. Every time a man comes to a lawyer, he says to the lawyer, what may I do? How much freedom do I have? That's when he feels like he wants to be expansive. The next time he comes in and says, where can I stop that guy? Draw a precise line for me. And when the lawyer says, I can only give you a precise line, which is sort of like Lake Chelan, like this, broad, wet, deep, and meandering, It's hard to explain to a person why this is necessary. But do you see this necessity for back and forth? Now, the necessity for precision varies from one kind of undertaking to another. For example, in the law of trusts and wills, where we plan things for the future, it's necessary that it be pretty stable and it doesn't change. While in the law of automobile accidents, it can turn over every day if we want to, as long as it's clear at the time, because people don't plan their next automobile accident. And that's not a planning activity. You don't say, well, today I'm going to be accidentally run over by a truck from Frederick and Nelson. That just happens, see? You may have to do something about insurance, but it isn't like planning a corporate future for your corporation either. Well, in the antitrust field, the solution finally worked out was, let's give it to a body of experts. The Federal Trade Commission. We'll put their group of men, we'll call them commissioners, and they will be experts in this field. And we will ask them, is this good for business or is this not good for business? All that you've done is to transfer from the judgment of nine judges as to whether or not it's good, per se bad, or reasonable, down to five Federal Trade Commissioners and ask them whether it's good or bad. And you really haven't assisted your freedom case very much. Now, with the last 4 or 5 minutes that I've got here, let's get down to the case that I sucked you in with in the first place, as being a final illustration of what all of this is about. Sandpaper shave case. Colgate Company manufactured the product, and then they said on television that it would shave sandpaper. You remember? I suppose almost all of you saw the ad one time or another. This stuff is so good that it will even shave sandpaper. And then they proceeded to show you a picture of squirt it on the sandpaper and whip out the razor and zip, you got nice clean paper. The thing that was wrong with that was that it wasn't sandpaper that you were seeing at all. It was another kind of material with plexiglass beads sprayed on it instead of sand. And they weren't really shaving sandpaper back there in the studio at all. They were shaving a studio mock-up. Now you will notice immediately that nobody has said that it won't shave sandpaper, and as a matter of fact, it will shave sandpaper. Nobody's misrepresenting anything here in terms of what the product will do. It's just that when you photograph a piece of sandpaper, it doesn't go over television very well. It's much easier to photograph other things. After all, that bread that you used to see on television, don't ever try to eat it. It's made of plaster of Paris or something else, see? And that lovely ice cream that you see there, under the hot Klieg lights of a television studio, huh? No, of course that's not ice cream that you're seeing there. Federal Trade Commission at this point said, this is a misrepresentation to people. You're telling them you're shaving sandpaper, and you aren't shaving sandpaper. And you've got to stop this, because you can't lie to the public. We're out to protect the public. Now, this is part of the antitrust field, protecting the consumer. Colgate said, do you deny that it shaves sandpaper? Nope. Do you think we're telling them a lie? No. You're showing them one. They don't see any sandpaper. They don't see any plexiglass. What they see is a television screen with little lights and shadows up there. They don't see in their homes anything except a representation. And at this point, we see something which we don't see very often in law. They started arguing about what is reality. When the tree falls down in the forest and there's no one there to hear it, is there any noise? Or does it take a human ear to transfer the sound waves into something that we call sound? You don't very often get this in the United States Supreme Court. And they stand there and they argue for a while about whether or not you see sandpaper in the studio over there or whether you only see representations out here. And if the representation looks like sandpaper, isn't that an accurate representation? Well, pretty soon the justices say, enough, enough. Metaphysics is for metaphysicians. We hear our lawyers, let's talk about whether or not there is a misrepresentation, and there is. Colgate swallows hard and says, now tell me again, how did you get there? How is this a misrepresentation? Because it isn't sandpaper, and you're using something which looks better than sandpaper looks, and you're misrepresenting. You're giving the people an image that really isn't there. And counsel looks the judge in the eye at this point, and he says to him, Your Honor, what if we photographed a product, and because of its propensities, it came out over the tube looking much better than it actually looks back in the studio? Is that a misrepresentation? All we're trying to do is to make it look the same as it does by a prop. What if we photograph the real thing and it looks much better? Then is that a misrepresentation, or can we go on deceiving people by photographing the real thing and letting them look at something which looks so much better on the screen? The judge did what they always do in this kind of case and say, get us that case and bring it here and we'll decide it. Right now, that's not the case we have to talk about. This is known as the economy of judicial decision. We want to decide real cases, and there's real merit in this. Now, what has this case to do with what I've been talking about so far? This case has this to do with it. That in the attempt to prescribe what is the fair, the ethical, the proper way of doing it, you once more are drawing pretty tight lines around what a competitor may do to compete. And every time that you lay down a rule for him as to what he must do, how he must do it, when you describe your product, describe it in these words and no other words. When you bottle your whiskey, bottle it in this bottle and no other. When you photograph sandpaper, you photograph this product and nothing else. Each one of these things eliminates a certain amount of the imagination and the ingenuity, which is the very lifeblood of the competitive struggle. Because if a man wants to have competition, he must be free to innovate. Now, of course, he can't innovate to the place where he becomes an Alcoa, and by his very smog-like presence destroys. Once more, you've got to hit the middle groove. And this is a question of judgment. This is a question of judgment. This is not a question of ultimate and absolute rights and wrongs. This is a question of middle ground judgment. How should that judgment be made? Once more, it ought to be made this way. The principle that we're fighting for is to ultimately give the greatest amount of goods of the best quality to the most people at the lowest price. It is a test of efficiency, of utility, because that's what's good for man here. The way that we think we can do this, we bought this as a theory, is the competitive struggle. How does one protect people and get them all of those benefits? Protect competition. The confusion in the sandpaper shave case is that you decide to protect people, consumers, rather than protecting the system. Because it is the system, it is the competitive system itself which will give you these better goods at lower prices and greater quality. The law ought not to protect you. It ought to protect the system which produces for you. Final ultimate truth. This is always true of law, and I would like for you to see this as we leave this subject this morning. As a lawyer, I am never interested in the person of my client. A doctor is. A doctor likes to have them limp in and run out, renewed. A psychiatrist is. He likes to have them come in brushing off the imaginary grasshoppers and going out a whole man. A lawyer is not. I am not interested in the person as a lawyer. I am not interested in the person as a person. I am interested in protecting the systems which society has built, because to protect the integrity of those systems and keep them operating in a reasonably whole way will permit people to realize the greatest amount of freedom inside of those systematic patterns that is possible. This is precisely the place in which theology and law must ultimately meet, because God has also done this to us. God has made us free. He has removed from us the restraints. And he then has said, go out and innovate, go out and develop, go out and exercise your dominion, go out and build, go out and use the freedom and intelligence which God gives you. At this point, law and theology adopt similar patterns. The difficulty for man is, of course, to be able to make those decisions intelligently. Now, tomorrow morning, Paul gets to tell you how the economist picks up from this point and sees what we lawyers do to destroy his whole system. In my hour tomorrow morning, Chaplain Mathry and I will be talking about crime and punishment.